This is the takeaway for Wednesday, November 22nd, 2017. And don't forget, you can take our takeaway podcast with you on this holiday Thursday and Friday, wherever you usually get your podcasts. The news keeps going.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us here today. 7 million people are facing famine and starvation in Yemen. It's just one crisis in the 2.5 years of war in Yemen. 10,000 civilians have been killed, 2 million people have been displaced, and the International Red Cross estimates that 1 million Yemenis may be infected with cholera by the end of the year. The story of this war is often told as a conflict pitting the central government in Yemen against the Houthi rebels, the rebels backed by Iran, the government backed by Saudi Arabia. And it's true, but that story and the way it's told here misses something critical to this war, the United States. In just a minute, we'll look at how and why America's intimate role in Yemen gets left out of news coverage. But first, we turn to Iona Craig, an investigative journalist who's covered the conflict in Yemen extensively. Welcome.
Good to talk to you.
Iona, Yemen is known to many Americans as ground zero for the U.S. drone war. It's where Anwar al-Awlaki was killed. How has U.S. involvement there changed from the days right after 9/11? Is the United States still fighting the war on terror as we know it in Yemen?
Yes, it is. But I think what's changed predominantly on that front is who they're supporting to do that, to fight that counterterrorism war, and how it's being carried out. So under the Obama administration, going back and even before then, it was always through supporting the former president of Yemen, Saleh, with training and funding of counterterrorism troops locally, as well as, of course, the drone program with airstrikes and even naval bombardments. Now, because of the current conflict in Yemen, that has changed a lot. All of those counterterrorism forces now are actually fighting against the US-backed forces in Yemen. And all that training that was used in Yemen over many decades has been effectively turned against US allies now in Yemen. So now the United Arab Emirates are the main forces that the U.S. is supporting. But most notably, under the Trump administration, the amount of airstrikes and drone strikes and military operations on the ground has escalated massively.
Well, Iona, I want to be very clear about what you just said, because it's remarkable. The forces on the ground in Yemen that the United States has been using for many years to counter al-Qaeda cells in Yemen, they've essentially switched sides, and now that the U.S. is backing Saudi Arabia and its proxies in Yemen, the people that we trained and that we armed and that we funded are now fighting against us.
Absolutely. That's the case on the ground at the moment. All of those forces that were trained under President Saleh are now fighting against the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition. And in addition to that, you've got al-Qaeda and Islamic State, although Islamic State is only in small numbers in Yemen, are fighting on the side of the Saudi coalition right now on the ground. So, yeah, on both sides now, you've got al-Qaeda on the side of effectively the U.S., on paper at least, whilst the counterterrorism troops that they trained are fighting against U.S. interests.
So talk a little bit more about how the American role then has changed since the start of this proxy war in Yemen, since 2015.
Well, the most crucial part of that has been on two fronts, really. Since the Saudis became involved militarily in Yemen in March 2015, the U.S. has played a key role in supporting Saudi Arabia and the coalition of regional nations that have been involved both in the air war and the ground war. So the U.S. role in that has been historically of obviously selling weapons over many, many years to Saudi Arabia in the form of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia. And this is the first modern war that Saudi Arabia has fought, the first time they've had a chance to use these weapons. But also, most crucially, logistically, the U.S. is currently refueling fighter jets of the Saudi coalition. So that's United Arab Emirates planes, fighter jets, as well as Saudi, in order for them to be able to carry out those bombing runs. And in addition to that, U.S. Navy warships have been active in the Red Sea, which is the area that the Saudi coalition has been blockading, preventing commercial food supplies and even more recently humanitarian supplies from accessing into the most densely populated area of Yemen. So that's been the most crucial aspect on the war front. On the other side, they're still carrying out drone strikes in the counterterrorism war against al-Qaeda and Islamic State. and carrying out Navy SEAL raids and supporting the UAE and their attempts to fight Al-Qaeda. So the US is fighting on two fronts, essentially, indirectly on one side and more directly on the other.
What you're describing, Iona, is a situation, it sounds like, where the polls have basically reversed in terms of U.S. involvement. When President Obama left office, there was a subtle but noticeable warming toward Iran with the Iran nuclear deal. The Saudis were unhappy about it. It seems now with President Trump, that warming has been completely iced over, and you can see it in Yemen and where the United States is fighting over and in Yemen.
Yes, and this has been a crucial change in language, really. Under the Obama administration, their reason for supporting the Saudi-led coalition was to reinstate President Hadi, who was forced into exile in March 2015, just before the Saudis became involved. And that was always the language that was coming out of the Obama administration. Now, what has shifted under the Trump administration is about supporting the Saudis because they see the Houthi rebels who took over large parts of the country as being a proxy for Iran. And that's the big shift. It's taking up the Saudi cause almost, if you like, of seeing the Houthis as a strong ally and a proxy of Iran. And that's obviously potentially very dangerous because what happens is it becomes something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Houthis were certainly politically aligned to Iran, but there was very little evidence, certainly back in 2014 and the beginning of 2015, of any real support beyond that of the Iranians. But as the Saudis have complained and used the Iranian involvement as a pretext for this conflict, it has actually resulted in more Iranian involvement, if anything. And the language now coming out of the US government makes it even more likely that Iran will then use the Houthis, or certainly the conflict in Yemen, almost as a stick to beat the Saudis with.
Well, Iona, there's a question that Americans got used to asking themselves in conflicts like this, and I wonder if we've forgotten it. Does the United States have a clear objective in Yemen, and does it have an exit strategy?
If they do, I don't think anybody has an idea what that is. But at the moment, that relationship between the U.S. now and the Saudis has been strengthened under the Trump administration and cooled, obviously, against the Iranians. And that's really the significance in the current context of the conflict at the moment. And it could actually help extend the conflict because of that change.
Investigative journalist Iona Craig, one of the reporters bringing the world the true story on the ground in Yemen. Iona Craig, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if the United States is playing such a critical role in the war in Yemen, why aren't we, American media consumers, hearing much about it? Adam Johnson is a media analyst for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. They're a national media watchdog group. He's also host of the Citations Needed podcast. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Adam, what in your view do Americans hear about the war in Yemen versus the reality of the war in Yemen?
Well, for the most part, they don't really hear much at all in general. So the war in Yemen over the past 2.5 years or so has been pretty much ignored. And when it is mentioned, the degree of U.S. complicity and involvement in the war is either omitted entirely or trivialized or kind of thrown in a throwaway line in paragraph 19.
Now, why do you think that is? Why is it that if American media companies are aware of U.S. involvement in, say, Saudi Arabia's proxy war in Yemen, they're not reporting on it?
That's obviously a kind of a complex question, but generally speaking, when Americans aren't coming home in body bags, American media don't have a tendency to center America's involvement. Now, as you explained earlier in the show, the U.S. involvement in the war is pretty extensive, but this is not as sort of sexy or as narratively interesting as direct troop involvement, so it's typically downplayed. And there's also, of course, the ideological reasons for it, which is that U.S. corporate media in general doesn't really like to talk about U.S. involvement overseas. As a sort of general rule, it has a tendency to downplay it or obfuscate it.
Well, let's do a little bit of media analysis here because we have an example that I'd like you to react to, Adam. Listen to this clip from 60 Minutes this past weekend, where the show went and did some really pretty good on-the-ground reporting in Yemen, or at least tried to. Here's Scott Pelley of 60 Minutes talking about what happened when the Saudis rescinded an invitation to visit Yemen.
David Beasley runs the World Food Program, the UN's emergency first responder to prevent famine.
We were headed into Yemen with the World Food Program. The Saudis gave us permission to come, and then when we arrived, they wouldn't let us into the country. What do you think they didn't want us to see?
I don't understand why. They won't allow the world to see what's taking place, because I think if the world sees the tragedy of this human suffering, number one, the world will step up and provide the support financially for innocent children to eat.
Adam, David Beasley's been on this program. What's missing from that clip that we just heard from 60 Minutes in your view?
Well, the fact that the 60 Minutes centered an American as the hero of the crisis, I think, was another layer of obfuscation. So you have the sort of overall omission of U.S. involvement, which they didn't mention at once, which is part of a broader trend. As I noted in my piece in Fair, two Washington Post editorials and a Washington Post explainer in the past 2 weeks have completely ignored the U.S. military role in Saudi Arabia. So they not only did that, they went one step further and kind of centered an American as the hero by saying the U.S. provides the bulk of funding for the U.N. food aid program, and then centered David Beasley, an American, as the hero of the story, which is somewhat perverse, I think, without at least having a throwaway line about how the U.S. military is what has made this war possible. Bruce Rydell is a senior fellow at Brookings and a 30-year veteran of the CIA. I think put it best. He said, quote, "If the United States and the United Kingdom tonight told the King of Saudi Arabia this war has to end, it would end tomorrow. The Royal Saudi Air Force cannot operate without American and British support." So this isn't some support that is incidental. It's support that's essential and crucial and fundamental to the war itself.
But in terms of the reporting of that support, I just want to make this clear. It's information that's easily at hand to American journalists and their editors. They wouldn't have to dig down into the archives classified information.
Yeah, anyone who follows the story and follows Yemen knows that American support is essential to the war itself. And it's not something, by the way, that the media never mentions. I mean, the New York Times had an editorial last year that clearly stated America's complicity in war crimes. So this isn't something that's not known. It's just something that's often omitted. And I think if you're an American media outlet talking to American people, it's really essential that you focus and center the American involvement, since that's the thing we can do something about. And this is, I think, what makes the lack of mentioning of U.S. involvement by 60 Minutes and the Washington Post so offensive, is that the thing that we can actually do, the thing we can actually affect as Americans, is we can call congresspeople, we can write letters, we can write emails, we can, you know, lobby on social media and through other means, and tell friends to lobby on social media. So when you remove the American involvement, you take away the connection between what the public can view and what they can actually do to stop the tragedy they're seeing on the TV. Because when you strip it of political context and when you strip it of American responsibility, it effectively becomes nothing more than crisis porn. All you can do is sort of hand-wring. It's what Adam Curtis calls odierism. You can sort of watch and go, well, isn't that a tragedy? So when you don't tell Americans that this is actually their government doing it, then you render them politically impotent, and it really takes the urgency out of the problem.
Well, Adam Johnson, I'm going to let you go, but before I do, point takeaway listeners in the direction of an article, a piece that you've seen that gets it right, where they can really go and find some Yemen coverage that hits the mark.
Well, there's general alternative media. I think like Democracy Now! And The Intercept have done good work on it. But there actually was an editorial, as I mentioned earlier, in the New York Times called America's Moral Duty in Yemen from October of last year that kind of scolded Obama to stop the war, that I thought was actually pretty good. It was one of the rare examples of major media putting it in clear moral terms and also placing the blame where it belongs, which is with U.S. officials and the U.S. military.
Adam Johnson with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and host of the Citations Needed podcast. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Rules controlling how big corporations rule the internet are about to go away. On Tuesday, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai said he'll put net neutrality regulations up for a vote in the commission in December. And that vote is expected to pass along party lines. And that means net neutrality is likely to be repealed. Well, big telecom companies agree with Pai here. Internet companies like Google and Netflix don't. So we wanted to look at what undoing net neutrality could mean for individual Americans and small businesses. Here to help is David Chofness. He's assistant professor of computer science at Northeastern University. David, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Professor, a little refresher, I think, might help us out here at the top. What exactly is net neutrality, and what does that phrase mean? How does it work in the real world?
So net neutrality is one of those things that means different things to different people. But at a high level, the idea is that all internet traffic should be treated the same by our network providers, whether it's video, whether you're visiting a website. Essentially, you should get equal access to any content that you want to access over the internet.
You say the data should be treated the same. Does that just mean the speed with which the data flows down the pipe?
Yeah, so for example, we expect that you could watch Netflix and stream at exactly the same bitrate that you could some other video service like YouTube. We expect that you could access Google or Bing or whatever your search engine is without, say, any kind of interference from your network provider forcing you to visit one or the other. And that also the content that you access over the internet, when you're accessing a news site, they're not going to interfere with that content and replace it with something else. So basically, the idea is that the network provider is supposed to leave your data alone.
Well, why would a network provider want to do anything but? I mean, what stake would they have in making my Netflix faster than my Amazon or sending me to Bing instead of Google?
So network providers, in the end, are companies. And the obligation that they have is to their bottom line and to their shareholders. So their goal is to make money. So if, for example, they could make more money by selling you a plan that gives you faster Netflix for more money, then that's something that they might be able to profit from. If, for example, they could inject their own ads into your web content, then they could make more money from those ads than if they didn't.
Would they also like to get a payment, or dare I call it a kickback, from the New York Times to make sure that you don't go to the Washington Post?
Right. So that's another example of something that they could do. They could decide to give priority access to one company over another in exchange for some fee.
Well, David Chaffness, we got lots of questions from Takeaway listeners about net neutrality and how it might affect them. So here's a question from one of our listeners, Jack, which I think gets right to the heart of the debate here.
My question is, why isn't the internet under common use like phone communication?
Well, that's a question that goes right to the core of this, David Chaffness, doesn't it? What does the government consider the internet to be? Is it a public utility? Is it regulated like a utility, like the phone company?
Right. That's a great question. And it really depends on who you ask. So if you look at what the FCC ruled under the Obama administration, the answer is yes. And at a certain level, that makes sense because increasingly we use the internet like a public utility. We use it for health and safety during emergencies. We use it to keep in touch with family, friends, and loved ones, whether they're down the street or whether they're across the world. On the other hand, what we have is commission that is making decisions as to how to regulate it that very much depends on which party happens to be in power. So with the answer changing depending on the administration, it leads to a lot of confusion. And so this is one of the issues that's at stake right now.
So the federal courts have said, yes, it's a utility. Does FCC Chairman Ajit Pai essentially say, no, it isn't?
That's what they are going to claim. And so we'll see what happens. It is very likely there will be lawsuits to challenge the validity of that. But ultimately, I think what we need, if we want to move forward, is to establish laws that actually set in place stable rules as to how to classify the internet. That's something some lawmakers are floating right now. But in the short term, I think this will be fought in the courts.
Well, here's another question from a Takeaway listener. This is from Susanna. She writes, I'm worried about losing net neutrality because I work in the internet industry. I worry I won't have a job if startups can't build new apps without bribing ISPs, and if I have to pay a fortune to use a VPN to work from home. David, is that a legitimate concern?
Parts of it certainly are. So, for example, if you are a startup that provides a streaming video service, you could find yourself having to pay large amounts of fees to get access to the same amount of bandwidth as other larger companies such as Netflix or Hulu. So in that sense, this could potentially harm innovation. On the other hand, it seems less likely that ISPs will block an entire class of services like a VPN. So I think some of the concerns are warranted, but the idea that ISPs will start censoring the internet seems less likely just because that would cause outrage and that would be harmful to the bottom line.
Justin on Twitter is asking how the big giant content providers are going to hold their own against the big ISPs like Comcast and AT&T. He writes on Twitter, are there large corporations who will suffer from this? Amazon, Netflix, and Google. What's stopping them from making their own infrastructure, just going around these other big companies?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there is certainly potential for harm for even the big companies. And, you know, why aren't they building their own infrastructure? It ends up that operating networks at a nation scale or even a global scale is extremely expensive. We've seen Google try to do this by providing fiber to the home in small regions. And somewhat recently, they decided not to pursue this venture any further. So this gives us some evidence that as large as these tech giants are, they just don't have the resources or the operational capacity to run their own networks.
Well, David, you said you think it's unlikely that ISPs will try to just censor content on the internet. That would get controversial. We got this question from Hussein Rashid. He's a frequent guest on our program, and he asks, how do net neutrality and religious freedom intersect? Can a provider refuse to carry certain religious voices, charge you differently if you want to read a Quran or a Tanakh or the Vedas?
It's certainly a valid concern, but like I said earlier, it seems unlikely that companies would want to do this just because of the outrage. It might also cause lawmakers to pass specific laws preventing that from happening. And beyond that, there's probably constitutional questions as well.
David Chaffness is Assistant Professor of Computer Science at Northeastern University. David, have a great holiday.
Thanks, you too.
Oh my goodness, political talk with the family over the holidays. This is a landmine.
Political talk, the holiday landmine. You can step on one in the kitchen, in the living room, during NFL commercials. The dinner table is basically a minefield. Now, everybody says they hate talking about politics at Thanksgiving or that they'll avoid it, but look around you. What else is there to talk about?
This is Judy from Boston. And yes, politics has divided my family in the era of Trump. During this holiday, I'm hoping to not be confronted by ignorance. And also, I plan to drink a lot of wine.
I don't know if the wine will help Judy in Boston, but you can at least commiserate with your takeaway friends. We actually polled this, and the new Takeaway Harris poll says 47% of you avoid talking about politics at all costs during the holidays. Now, I have to be honest, I'm not sure I'm buying this one. Avoid politics at all costs? Sure. So talk about the movies that you've seen lately. Just avoid the ones with Kevin Spacey or produced by Harvey Weinstein. Okay, then sports. Sports, yes, that's the safe space from politics. Okay, just not the NFL. That's definitely political now. Okay, how about the NCAA? College basketball? Oh, wait, President Trump had a Twitter rant about LaVar Ball just this morning. So you see my point. This is the Trump era. Politics is everywhere. And it better be. 38% of you say political conversations have gotten more heated during the Trump administration.
This is Lee from North Bergen. And yes, this election brought many tearful and impassioned conversations in my family. It shook me to my core and had me questioning things I had never dreamed I would. This Thanksgiving, I'm going to do my best to avoid political conversations since we've all already made ourselves and our positions clear. I'll focus on being grateful that the ones I love are healthy.
Okay, so how does this work around your Thanksgiving table?
My name is Sandy from Boulder Creek, and with the Italian side of the family, arguing about politics is expected and accepted, so we do. However, with my daughter and her conservative Republican husband's family, we all agree to not discuss politics.
This is Augustine in Orlando. Political talk has never divided our family so much as it has made for some exciting, lively, and you can say turkey-digesting conversations. You see, above all, we love, we care about each other as well as respect each other's rights to their opinion. So we challenge each other's opinion while reevaluating our own.
See, that's the way to do it, Augustine in Orlando. For some of you, politics is the gladiator's arena.
This is Barry Wynn calling from Brighton, Michigan. In my family, we go full bore, no holds barred, free for all. The weak are thrown out with the turkey carcass. Every opinion is welcome and subject to ridicule.
About half of you in our poll say you'll change the subject if politics come up. And 1 in 10, the ultimate cop-out, just drink more.
Hi, this is Karen Hayes from East Northport, New York. What we do to avoid any heated discussions is we just sing karaoke. It seems that Frank Sinatra is definitely a good force in uniting us all.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance.
Well, that's our poll. And I got to say, I'm challenging the results here. Half of you say you're avoiding politics. No, you're takeaway listeners. There's too much to talk about to let your family off the hook. But if you need to blow off steam, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can see the results of our Takeaway Harris holiday poll at thetakeaway.org. When you sit down to Thanksgiving tomorrow, you're probably not going to give too much thought to where your food came from or whether it's at risk. But as populations explode and farms become increasingly vulnerable to extreme weather, humans might have to rethink how we feed ourselves. That's the topic for the next installment of the mini-docs from Quartz and Retro Report called The Future of Food. Will and Sherilyn Ortman are farmers with Berrybrook Organics in Marion, South Dakota. They're featured in that documentary, and they decided to make the switch away from conventionally grown crops.
Diversity is pretty key to the organization. So Will likens it to diversifying a stock portfolio. You don't have all your eggs in one basket financially, so you're not as vulnerable to changing markets or lessening demand. And of course, from an organic perspective, things like livestock are kind of important from a fertilizer perspective to the things that you're growing in the field. So we find that all the different elements really need to work together. And the more diversified your operation can be, the more benefits that you can potentially realize in your operation.
Will, what's different about your business on the business side of the farm that's different from so many larger operations that do industrial scale farming? Certainly every farm in America can't be organic and people probably aren't willing to pay the premium. But you are doing something that you say does have a good bottom line.
The consumer right now, and certainly the millennial generation, they're interested in food produced a certain way without use of petroleum-based inputs, without genetic modified seeds. And in return, they're basically saying to the organic farmer that they will pay a premium. And the organic premiums allow for smaller operations. It's the difference between profitability and losing money in some cases. And for our operation, that was the case. From a business perspective, organic farming actually is beneficial also on the expense side because, you know, we're not as exposed to the fossil fuel industry.
I would just add, going organic has given us some great opportunities to control our own destiny price-wise more. We see that conventional farmers are really at the mercy of the markets.
So, Sherilyn, as people think about how to feed a growing population, I mean, I saw one statistic, I think, in the film, 9 billion people on Earth, you know, in the next 40 to 50 years. Mm-hmm. Operations like yours, I mean, do you feel like you're in a niche? You've got this unspoken agreement between your farm and American consumers, the ones who can afford to pay a little bit more for what you're offering. I'm not sure that's a solution worldwide. I'm not sure that's a solution in Asia or Africa or even places in the United States where populations are going to explode and incomes are going to be tight.
I think you're right. I think making quality food affordable is a huge challenge. I think some of the concerns about organic crops not being able to keep pace with yields of conventional crops, I think perhaps some of those concerns are overstated. You know, if you think about food as one of the chief life-sustaining force in the world, we have to ask ourselves, what is it worth to have quality food? What does that mean for our health? What does that mean for our longevity? So there are bigger, I think, kind of ethical, moral, social issues and questions that come with that question of making organic food more accessible and more affordable.
Talk about the quality of soil, because it's one thing that's raised in the film. People don't think much about dirt, but you think about it a lot, and people are going to be thinking about it a little bit more as weather gets more extreme.
Soil is a living organism. The soil is the basis for civilization. We're trying to rebuild the life in the soil, and as you do that, there's symbiotic relationships between microbial life and plant life. And as the soil quality improves, the quality of the crops improve. And as the soil and crop quality improves, so does the health of the animal or the human that's eating that food.
Will and Sherilyn Ortman, you do run your own farm, and I know how busy you are and what hard work that is. And so I appreciate you taking time out. It means a lot.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Yeah. We have news now from the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Today, former Bosnian Serb General Ratko Mladic was convicted of war crimes, of genocide, and crimes against humanity. Mladic was the top general in the Bosnian Serb army during the war that followed the breakup of Yugoslavia. He led the campaign to ethnically cleanse Muslims, Croats, and other non-Serbs, and he earned the nickname the Butcher of Bosnia. An estimated 100,000 people died in Bosnia during the Balkans War of the 1990s, including the mass executions of more than 7,000 Muslim men and boys. Joining me now, Julian Borger. He's World Affairs Editor for The Guardian and author of The Butcher's Trail. Julian, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
Many Americans might remember the name Ratko Mladic from the years of the war in Bosnia. Remind us of who he is and what his role was.
He was an officer in the Yugoslav army who took over the Bosnian Serb army when Yugoslavia fell apart, led the Bosnian Serb army right through that war from 92 to 95, and oversaw the mass killings that took place along the course of that war.
So what were these specific charges against Ratko Mladic?
Well, there were two counts of genocide, another 9 counts involving crimes against humanity and assorted war crimes. The counts of genocide, obviously the most important, one for the massacre in 95 in Srebrenica, a Muslim enclave that was supposed to have been protected by the UN, and the other, a more general genocide charge that applied to various municipalities across Bosnia.
Julian, can you give a sense of the trial? It took several years. These trials often proceed very slowly, but what kind of people came to court to testify against Ratko Mladic?
You're right. It took a very long time, about 5 years, 530 days of trial days, and more than 500 witnesses, most of them eyewitnesses to slaughter. It was a grueling, grueling trial in terms of sitting there and listening to the families of people who had been killed in mass executions, often people talking about the loss of their husbands, their sons. It was very much a grind through some of the worst atrocities Europe has seen since the Second World War.
And how did the prosecution establish that Ratko Mladic, from his command position, was responsible for the atrocities that were described?
To be honest, it wasn't very hard. The Bosnian and Serb army was fairly centralized. He gave out and made clear that he was in command, giving out orders. He also had himself filmed, for example, at Srebrenica, swaggering into town, giving orders, and with some of the civilians in the aftermath of the fall of Srebrenica, assuring them that everyone would be safe, while knowing that in the next couple of days, his men would carry out those mass executions.
So, Julian, more than 20 years later, the Bosnian War, the Yugoslav War is over, and there's this grim cast of characters who people have heard about and followed for these many years. Radovan Karadzic, Slobodan Milosevic, now Ratko Mladic. Can you give a little bit of context into whether some form of justice has been served so many years after the war ended?
Yes, I mean, it's always hard to estimate. I mean, if you talk to, say, the mothers of Srebrenica, they'll say, well, this is nothing like justice enough. But the truth is there can never be enough justice for the kind of crimes, the kind of mass crimes that were committed in Bosnia. But what we do know is that the Hague Tribunal, the ICTY, is the best attempt at international justice for these mass crimes since the Second World War, since the Nuremberg Tribunal. It indicted 161 people. It accounted for all those 161. Most were brought to court and went through a proper trial, and many, many were convicted. And so although it'll never be enough for the survivors and for the families of the victims, and there are many more people out there who are undoubtedly guilty of crimes who will never be convicted, it is the best the world has done so far or since in terms of handling this problem of mass crimes.
And the former Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic, remind us what became of him.
He died while his trial was underway. And in a way, this is one of the shortcomings, the missing links in the work of the Hague Tribunal, is that so far it hasn't, in a court of law, quite established that link between Belgrade, the nerve center, the capital of the former Yugoslavia, and the killings in Bosnia and Croatia. And what is known from people who were in Belgrade at the time, people around Milosevic, is that this was all part of a grand plan to create a greater Serbia. What hasn't yet come out in the court, because of a lot of the records were destroyed, was that a lot of the orders for this ethnic cleansing in Bosnia and Croatia came direct from Belgrade, and that Belgrade was very much the center of everything that happened in those wars in the 1990s.
Former Bosnian Serb commander Ratko Mladic found guilty by the International Criminal Court and due to spend the rest of his life in jail for his role in the massacre at Srebrenica. Julian Borger, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
Julian Borger is World Affairs editor for The Guardian and author of The Butcher's Trail, How the Search for Balkan War Criminals Became the World's Most Successful Manhunt. I'm Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. And, you know, in life, Winston Churchill was bigger than life. And that's probably why writers and actors have always been drawn to him.
I feared it would be my hard lot to announce the greatest military disaster.
Famous have been the reigns of our queens. Some of the greatest periods in our history.
Compared to, say, Louis B. Mayer, how's he doing?
War with Germany will come, and we will need a king whom we can all stand behind.
We stand at a crossroads, Doctor, quite alone.
Well, screenwriter Anthony McCarten felt like he had something to add here, and he enlisted actor Gary Oldman to bring Winston Churchill to life. This film is about the soaring speeches and also the quiet moments, like here, where Churchill negotiates with King George VI.
I believe we are to meet regularly.
Once a week, I'm afraid. How are you for Mondays?
I shall endeavor to be available on Mondays.
4 o'clock?
I nap at 4.
Is that permissible?
No, but necessary. I work late.
Darkest Hour is in wide release today. It takes you away from the battlefields of World War II to Britain and to the offices, the dilemmas, and the doubts of Winston Churchill. I sat down with screenwriter Anthony McCarten and asked what drew him to Winston Churchill.
I wanted to do a portrait in leadership and also a study in the power of the word. At the center of this movie is a proposition that words matter, that they count, and in fact can be enlisted to change the world. And in Winston Churchill, we have the embodiment of that proposition. He was a guy who by the end of his life had written and published more words than Charles Dickens and Shakespeare combined. And in fact, three of the real doozies that Winston wrote and delivered were done within 4 weeks of each other. That was the essence of the start of the movie, to look at those 4 weeks and ask, why did he write them? How did he write them? Where did he write them? What forces were really pressing on him to inspire this incredible outburst of rhetoric?
There's a division here between the historical record, the transcripts of what Winston Churchill said in the halls of Parliament, that's all real, and then your own sort of artistic license in putting words in his mouth. And there's both of those things in this film that you kind of mesh together.
Yeah. The big revelation for me diving into the research was how uncertain he was. And on the critical issue of whether to do a peace deal with Adolf Hitler or not, which was the issue. And history doesn't really record how close the world came to Winston caving in to domestic pressure from his colleagues to sign a peace deal with Adolf Hitler that would, with the flourish of that pen, have consigned Europe to Nazi domination in perpetuity. It would have meant a quasi-peace deal with Germany that in reality would have meant the Germans taking a power position in Britain itself. It's unthinkable now. But it was a hair's breadth from happening. And the person that stopped it happening was Winston Churchill. And we almost can calculate the minute and the hour in which he switched and decided, you know what, we're going to fight.
Hitler will not insist on outrageous terms. He will know his own weaknesses. He will be reasonable.
When will the lesson be learned? When will
Will the lesson be learned? How many more dictators must be wooed, appeased, good God, given in mixed privileges, before we learn? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
Churchill always projected this image of steadfast defense of the island, defense of the realm, we shall fight, we shall fight. There was a time where if he was projecting that publicly, he didn't really believe it.
He didn't really believe it. And that's was the great revelation to me. And I think if there is news that this movie breaks, it's that, yes, he was uncertain. He changed his position not only by the day but by the hour. And rather than diminish him, however, I think he becomes more interesting and more considerable. Because for me, a leader who is capable of changing their mind is exactly the kind of leaders we need.
We've been busy in film for the last few years humanizing icons, I think. Steven Spielberg did Lincoln with Daniel Day-Lewis that did that to some degree. There's an LBJ movie out now from Rob Reiner. I'm a big LBJ fan, and he did that with Woody Harrelson. Your film, certainly The Crown on Netflix, does this with Queen Elizabeth II, and Winston Churchill, John Lithgow in this case, plays an enormous part in that story. These stories are popular. We're trying to lift the armor on our icons a little bit.
There's something going on, isn't there?
Yeah.
And possibly it is a sort of universal need to look back to the past for the qualities of leadership that have guided us through our most perilous hours, and saying, are those qualities visible today? And if not, can somehow they be, you know, revived? And one of the truly great qualities of Winston, apart from his ability to think that he might be wrong, and he was often wrong, let's face it, was his candor. He was a guy who was almost incapable of lying. And he would get himself in enormous trouble. You know, you could imagine his spin doctors in those days just putting their faces over their hands going, oh my God, you can't say that, Winston. It got him thrown out of power. As soon as he declared victory at the end of the war, they threw him out because he delivered more bad news. But he couldn't stop himself being honest.
Anthony, you said at the top of our interview that this is a story about the power of words, about oratory, and how great thinking and great words can move nations. Mm. Listeners, inevitably, are going to think about the current leadership in this country. They're going to think about President Trump and the way he uses words. And I'm positive you've thought about it too.
Sure. Yes, I have. We have to protect the power of words. We have to not use words in a way that are that demean them or diminish them, especially when they come from a leader. There's something of a climate where something is said one day and that statement is walked back the next day. This is not a British phrase that I'm used to, but I hear it a lot over here. Oh, yeah, I know what he said yesterday, but he walked it back.
He walked it back. It's all right.
He walked it back today. And and this, I've never heard of this phrase before, but it slightly gives me some alarm.
Well, it's enormously euphemistic, isn't it? Walked it back as though there's space to completely reverse yourself and say the opposite the next day.
And might it not have been better to have waited a day and made a statement that you don't have to walk back? Certainly that would be what I would hope for in any leader that represented me, is not, you know, seat of the pants talking that you disavow in the next moment, but considered words, weighted words, words that will galvanize in all our souls a desire to come together. And that's what great oratory does. It forges ties between people with huge differences. And suddenly everyone is a family. And it's happened through history. And that's one of the unique things that leaders, we hope, can provide us with.
The oratory and the words of Sir Winston Churchill at the dawn of World War II, conveyed through Gary Oldman in the new film Darkest Hour and through the pen of Anthony McCartan, who's the screenwriter. Thank you so much for being here.
Terrific. Thank you, Todd.
Well, as you cook or gather around the table tomorrow, or maybe you're working this holiday, we want to invite you to tune in to a special Takeaway tomorrow all about access to healthcare in America. We hope you'll join us in the car or in the kitchen or wherever you are. And if you are working, enjoy that time and a half, at least, I hope. Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.